Good morning.
Good morning.
In the beginning, this group gathered as the Boise Valley Unitarian Fellowship. A Unitarian church had collapsed during the Depression. The fellowship movement had a Unitarian population from which to gather members. Our first meetings were held in Bill Hopper's basement. After the two national associations joined, American Unitarian Association and the Universalist Church of America, we claimed the name of Boise Unitarian Universalist Fellowship. Various influences have brought us here. Each individual has a personal journey. John Harms, my father, founded the book Universalism in America by Ernest Gasara, expressed where he was in his journey most accurately and far more fully than his words could at the time. What is universalism? Reverend Michael McGee said universalism derives its name from the early theological doctrine which asserts that ultimately God will save all people. Universalists have always reasoned that if God is all-powerful, good, and loving, then he or she cannot possibly damn anyone for eternity. You may not realize that the concept of hell is relatively new. The early Greeks and Hebrews believed that after death, the soul entered into a shadowy existence called Hades for the Greeks, or Sheol for the Hebrews. This afterlife was a dreamlike existence with no punishment for one's sins. Cassara quotes Reverend Brainerd F. Gibbons from Gibbons' address to the Universalist Assembly in 1949. While fully aware of its Christian heritage, many equally sincere Universalists maintain an inherent spirit of inquiry that has carried Universalism beyond Christianity. A new type of universalism is proclaimed, which shifts the emphasis on universal from salvation to religion, and describes universalism as boundless in scope, as broad as humanity, and as infinite as the universe. Is this universalism's answer? A religion not exclusively Christian or any other named brand, but a synthesis of all religious knowledge which passes the test of human intelligence, a truly universal religion? Every universalist realizes that universalism has changed considerably since the days of its New England forebears, and many Christian dogmas have gradually supplanted. Even the sketchiest summary reveals the vast differences between then and now. Divine revelation has been replaced by human investigation, ignorance by knowledge, superstition by reason, the closed mind by the open, stagnation by progress, and celestial nonsense by common sense. Hence, universalists today consider all religions, including Christianity, expressions of human spiritual aspirations, not God-founded institutions. The Bible, a marvelous work of humans, not the miraculous handiwork of God. Jesus, a spiritual leader, not a divine savior. Humanity's fate in human hands, not superhuman clutches. Faith, the projection of known facts into the unknown, not blind creedal acceptance. And the supernatural, merely the natural beyond humankind's present understanding, not a violation of nature's laws. Indeed, universalism has disavowed many essential Christian doctrines. What remains that is uniquely Christian? God is not a Christian invention nor monopoly, and universalists find God more fully and truly revealed in the universe and humanity than in the Bible. Brotherhood is more reliably demonstrated by biology than the Bible, and is common to several world religions. The supreme value universalism places upon every human personality here and hereafter is actually more than Christian and is part of the philosophic speculation entirely divorced from Christianity. Universalism does not insist that we must swallow some Christian capsule of creedal beliefs that is of supreme value to be saved. The avowal of faith in Jesus as spiritual leader implies denial of him as God and hence of Christianity. The very name Christian is derived from the title of Christ given Jesus and accordingly to Christianity. However much universalists may revere Jesus as man and strive to follow in his footsteps, that alone does not make universalists Christian. At most, universalists are nominal Christians, and that solely by virtue of their own definition, a definition not acceptable to the great body of Christianity. For a long time, universalists have been reaching beyond the narrow bounds of Christianity to pluck their grapes of knowledge from the vines growing in the boundless vineyards of truth, and the religious wine pressed from them cannot be contained in the old Christian bottles. Only historical and emotional ties to Christianity have prevented universalists generally from realizing sooner the dynamic effects of the truth deliberately sought in and in which they now avow faith. Only fear of bigoted opinion will prevent an enlightened universalism from declaring to the world what fidelity to truth has made it, a unifying universal religion. From a 2000 sermon from Reverend Michael McGee, universalism was brought to America by the independent thinking mystic George de Benaville. De Benaville was of Huguenot extraction, but he was raised in England. He became a preacher of universalism in France during the reign of Louis XV and was arrested and sentenced to death for his heresy. At the last moment, he received a pardon because of his noble parentage and decided to emigrate to America for health reasons. That is, he wanted to avoid the guillotine. George de Benaville settled in Philadelphia, where he was successful at spreading the universalist message. He became a neighbor and friend of Benjamin Franklin and later served as a physician in the Revolutionary War. A universalist church did not exist, however, until the arrival of John Murray. It was over 200 years ago when John Murray began his universalist preaching in America, and ironically, it began with the one and only miracle story in our Unitarian Universalist tradition. Here's how it goes. Thomas Potter, not related to Harry Potter, was a wealthy farmer who lived on the New Jersey coast in the mid-1700s. After a thorough study of the Bible, Potter had concluded that God was a God of great love. As with many other religious liberals of his day, Potter was horrified that the Calvinist notion that God would save only a few elect men and women and that all others were predestined to an eternal damnation. Potter was convinced that a good God would never do such a thing. And he was further convinced that God would send him a preacher who would preach about a loving God. Potter proceeded to build his own church and settled down to wait for a universalist preacher to churn up. For the next 10 years, Thomas Potter's neighbors called his meeting house Potter's Folly. Then, in September of 1770, a ship grounded on a sandbar off the Jersey shore at a place called Good Luck. A man by the name of John Murray happened to be on board that ship. Murray had been a Methodist lay preacher in England who had been labeled a heretic because of his belief in universal salvation. His wife and children had died, and his business had failed, because causing him to be sent to debtor's prison. When his brother-in-law rescued Murray from prison, he set out for the new world to start a new life. When the ship struck the sandbar, the captain sent John Murray to shore for provisions. After trudging through the wetlands, Murray happened upon who else but Thomas Potter, who was overjoyed that God had finally sent him his universalist preacher. Potter begged John Murray to preach in his church, but Murray, not being a believer in miracles, declined. Finally, Murray decided that if the wind did not change, keeping the ship from sailing, he would preach in the church that coming Sunday. Potter had faith that the wind would not change and spread the word throughout the area that a universalist preacher would be in the pulpit that coming Sunday. Sure enough, the wind did not change, and Thomas Potter preached a sermon that knocked their socks off, or so it is said. The congregation asked John Murray to stay and become their preacher, but he declined. Instead, Murray settled in Gloucester, Massachusetts, and preached throughout New England, even occasionally traveling to New Jersey to preach in Potter's Chapel. Murray was often persecuted with welling, rotten eggs, and even rocks when he preached. Once, when addressing a group in Boston, a stone sailed through the air and almost hit him in the head. Murray picked up the stone and waved it in front of the audience. "This argument," he said, "is solid and weighty, but it is neither rational nor convincing." In 1779, Murray and a small group of enthusiastic Universalists founded the First Church of Gloucester, and it was that same church, under the leadership of John Murray, that helped bring about one of the most historic decisions of the Supreme Court. At that time, everyone was taxed to support the Congregational Church in their area. Some members of Murray's church refused to pay the tax, claiming that the Bill of Rights protected them from involuntary religious taxation. The court agreed, ruling that every individual could support the church of their choice. And so the Universalists helped to establish the principle of separation of church and state. John Murray ministered in Gloucester for 20 years and then moved to Boston to serve a Universalist church there. When he died in 1815, Universalism had grown into an organized and vital religious force in America. John Murray was the great organizer of the Universalist movement, but Hosea Ballou was its greatest preacher. Hosea was born in New Hampshire. His father was a Baptist minister. Hosea was ordained in 1794 and was a spiritual leader of the Universalists throughout the early 19th century. Hosea Ballou also had a sense of humor. Once someone from the audience questioned the doctrine of universal salvation. "What would you do with a man who died reeking in sin and crime?" the questioner asked. Ballou calmly replied, "I think it would be a good plan to bury him." The Universalists were quite different from the Unitarians of their days. Whereas the Unitarians were typically the Harvard intellectuals and the Boston social elite, the Universalists were mostly rural people who had come out of the Baptist and Methodist traditions. They were biblically oriented, using the Bible to prove that God never intended eternal damnation. Unlike Universalism, Unitarianism, Universalism was a spiritual movement that reached the common people. When a Universalist preacher would come to town, he or she would preach to whoever showed up. And if there was enough enthusiasm, a church would be founded on the spot. By 1840, just 70 years after John Murray landed on America, there was 800,000 Universalists. That's about four times the number of Unitarian Universalists in North America right now. The Universalist Church had actually become a mass movement. What appealed to so many was that this was a church that moved people through love rather than fear. Universalist worship services were often as emotional and spiritual as the evangelical churches, only without the hellfire and brimstone that was used to manipulate people by scaring them into conversion. Universalists have made quite an impact on American culture. Dr. Benjamin Rush was a medical reformer and signer of the Declaration of Independence, as well as a Universalist. Mary Livermore, a reformer, lecturer, and advocate of women's rights, was a Universalist, as was Clara Barton, founder of the American Red Cross. Olympia Brown, one of the rooms of our church is named after, was the first woman to be ordained for the Universalist ministry in 1863. Other Universalists were involved in the abolitionist movement, prison reform, women's suffrage, and many other reform movements. Even Abraham Lincoln can be called something of a Universalist. Though he was not a churchgoer, he revealed his Universalist leanings during his campaign for Congress in 1846. Lincoln attended a church service conducted by Peter Cartwright, a noted evangelical preacher. Cartwright called on all who wished to go to heaven to stand up. All rose but Lincoln. The evangelist called for all to rise who didn't want to go to hell. All rose but Lincoln. "I am grieved," said Cartwright, "to see Abe Lincoln back there unmoved by these appeals. If he doesn't want to escape hell, will he tell us where he does want to go?" Lincoln got up slowly and said, "I'm going to Congress." Unfortunately, Universalism did not continue to grow as some had expected and others had feared. By 1961, when Unitarians and Universalists merged to create the Unitarian Universalist Association, the Universalists had dwindled from a mass movement of 800,000 strong in 1840 to only 50,000 members. What happened? How had such a popular church diminished so greatly in just over a century? The major reason for the decline of the Universalist Church, ironically, was the growth in the Universalist theology. The Universalists had become so successful that they almost put themselves out of business. When they began their movement in the late 1700s, there were virtually no other preachers who preached the doctrine of universal salvation. Thanks largely to their influence, the belief in universal salvation is visible today, though not official, in most of the mainstream churches. Now it is not a heresy in many churches to preach universalism. There were other reasons for the decline of Universalism. Though they were not dogmatic, their churches did not prize individual freedom of expression. The free flow of ideas was restricted in a way that slowed their spiritual evolution. And Universalists did not require the rigorous educational standards for their ministers that the Unitarians required. Their preachers were filled with the Spirit, but they lacked the intellectual discipline necessary for dependable scholarship. Universalism as a church had become almost extinct by the time of the merger, though you still can find many Universalist churches across our land today. But the concept of universal salvation is not of concern to most Unitarian Universalists today. The meaning of universalism has been transformed to give us a new inspiration for our age. Clarence Skinner, a well-known universalist, gave us this modern-day message of universalism. Humanity must enlarge the borders of consciousness to include the entire human race. High civilization is not the prerogative of any one race. The hope for peace on earth depends upon our outgrowing of smaller attachments. Our religion must take the form of a larger loyalty. The religion of greatness gives us the intellectual courage to face reality, whatever it may be. There is no middle way. It is greatness, universalism, or perish. Now, do we have anything tangible from the universalists? Well, the symbol of Unitarianism is a flaming chalice. What is the symbol for the universalism? The most appropriate symbol for universalism, I believe, is the circle. The circle represents an openness of the spirit, including the embracing of all peoples. The circle with an off-centered cross, as you see in your order of service, is one of the historical symbols of universalism. The position of the cross represents the importance of Christianity, and yet being off-centered tells the world that universalism is open to all religious traditions and truths. The same way the Unitarian Universalist symbol is two circles to honor our universalist roots, with an off-centered chalice, we're open to all religious traditions and truths. Contemporary universalism is a belief in the wholeness of the universe. It is a belief that all human beings and every living being is connected in a sacred and indivisible unity. It is the belief that our salvation as a people and a planet can come about only through love put into action. It is a belief in a free and responsible search for truth and meaning. One universalist has said that universalism is the biggest word in any language. It is not only the biggest word, but it is the biggest concept and probably our most hopeful vision for the future. Thank you.